quote, "We must always remember that history is precisely that, his story, and nothing more." The professor stressed how historians traditionally tend to color facts to suit their notions. Perhaps not intentionally all the time, but bias of one sort or another is generally present. Any king's chronicler, for example, would most likely bend over backward to make his employer look like a pretty good leader of men, whether this was so or not. Warped viewpoints of historic events often over the years become generally accepted fact and have great influence on our thinking. Often the records unearthed by archaeologists were originally falsified merely to establish ruling family dynasties. Scholars digging into the chronicles of ancient Egypt are familiar with the various listings of the kings and the falsifications found in some versions. The point of this is to make it perfectly clear that what we are told by history isn't necessarily so. And history's been telling us for years that the pyramid is just a giant megalomaniac funerary pyre by some pharaoh attempting to immortalize his memory. If one takes the time and effort to really study the Great Pyramid at Giza, the first conclusion must be that no people whose culture was only one step removed from the Stone Age could have possibly designed and built such a monument. In order to make the Great Pyramid fit the puzzle framework, a number of terribly obscure assumptions were made by Egyptologists. If you read any of the standard texts on the pyramid-building dynasties of Egypt, you will note that whenever the Great Pyramid is discussed, the material is prefaced with, quote, "Although there are no records, it is assumed that." It is also curious that this most remarkable of all man's monuments is usually granted only a few paragraphs, while the other monuments, which no doubt were erected as tombs, are accorded entire chapters. The obvious difference is that while the Great Pyramid is the most fantastic, there is no basis in historic fact for a detailed discussion of its builders and its purpose. The others have writings inside, and paraphernalia of the period were found inside. And some records were unearthed that describe the individuals responsible, and their mummies are inside. Such is not the case with the Great Pyramid, because it wasn't built for that purpose. All the rest of them are weaker, less impressive copies of such megalomaniac tendencies. It was there first, and that poses another mystery. Except with the creation of man, you don't start out with something perfect and then get worse with practice. Normally you practice and attain perfection. The Pyramid of Giza comes out perfect. Nothing in history to talk about. It gets a little paragraph, and all the copies have whole chapters because they're full of historic detail. In my opinion, the erroneous assumption that the Great Pyramid of Giza was a tomb for Cheops and nothing more, plus the assumption that civilizations did not exist prior to Sumeria and Egypt, Sumeria, of summer, not Sumeria, are the two grossest mistakes in all of man's recorded history. The generally accepted notion that mankind has no solid heritage beyond the digs of the ancient Middle East and the civilizations before capable of evolving mankind toward perfection have not flourished has retarded the overall consciousness that enhances character growth and harmony with the environment. It is my purpose to discuss every ramification of the Great Pyramid of Giza in an objective manner. The opening chapters deal with the structure's impressive size and precise construction. I debunk the tombic theory and attempt to supplant it with a thesis that withstands every assault of rationality. All right, let's go. The ancient Greeks wrote into the annals of history that the Great Pyramid at Giza was the first wonder of the ancient world. The genius of classical antiquity may have chosen more wisely than they themselves realized. Today, there is controversy regarding the Great Pyramid's origin and purpose, with our standard textbooks insisting that it was nothing more than a tomb for a megalomaniac pharaoh named Cheops, or Khufu, as the Egyptians called him. There is no hard fact on which this tomb theory is based, and there's an avalanche of evidence to the contrary. But in the eyes of orthodoxy, a pyramid is a tomb, 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 is a tomb. All the other pyramid-shaped monuments in Egypt were found to be tombs, so the Great Pyramid must be a tomb. At this point, the controversy isn't important, so rather than stress what the Great Pyramid is not, let's review some concrete, irrefutable facts about this wonder of wonders, which people go to school and live and die and never ever pay much attention to. First of all, there's no comparison between it and the others. You know what's going to happen now? A whole bunch of fundamentalists that haven't got the brains to figure out the mathematical features of the pyramid or the historical background are immediately going to lump what I'm doing into the nutty fringe pyramidologists. Just like when I try to rescue the truth of the lost tribes and their identity with the Celtic nations, I get lumped in with the error of British Israelite doctrine, which is a sectarian cult, which I'm not a part of. Why is it that evangelical Christians rejoice over the fulfillment of prophecy and the return of the Jew to Palestine and don't want to have the opportunity to rejoice in the fulfillment of God's promises to the sons of Joseph? And the answer to that is they haven't the courage to believe that God can do it. They remind me of Lex Miller at Stanford University. The debt I owe to him as a theologian is immeasurable. Famous New Zealand theologian, responsible for some of the finest and most incisive works on Christian ethics ever written. Studied under Karl Barth in Germany, was Reinhold Niebuhr's assistant at Union, head of the religion department at Stanford, with whom I did my dissertation, teaching that God spoke and out of nothing the worlds came into being. And I asked him one day, I said, Lex, how come you can teach that God speaks and the worlds are formed and you won't take the next step and believe that the same God raised up Jesus from the dead and that, as Paul said, that's the basis of our Christian faith? He said, Gene, I'm just so afraid that the resurrection can't be demonstrated, I don't want to base my faith on it. Well, Paul said, if Christ be not risen, our faith's vain. And we're false witnesses of God. I've never forgotten that. And I've found as I've gotten older, very few Christians really believe in the resurrection. You wouldn't have any trouble believing the miracle of healing if you believe in the resurrection. Same spirit that raised up Christ from the dead should quicken your mortal body. Christianity starts with a miracle. But most Christians don't want to have a faith frowned upon by a naturalistic world that starts with miracle. They don't want to do the hard work of having to look at the evidence. They'd rather sing, "Ask me how I know he lives. He lives within my heart." Most Christians want to be Gnostics. Base their faith on a subjective experience rather than the objective criteria of our faith, which is the resurrection. Most Christians don't want to have to study God's message in the stars. Too complicated. A lot easier just memorize 10 laws of salvation coming out of the Navigators in Colorado Springs. Or let a Catholic priest tell you you're saved. That's a lot easier. Why wouldn't Christians rejoice if God has a message for this age that he's going to proudly display through the millennium with an "I told you so, you're without excuse, it was written there in stone"? Well, I'm afraid it can't be demonstrated. Fine, it isn't like trying to translate the New Testament from the Greek. If the pyramid won't stand the test, forget it. At the very least, if it doesn't contain a prophetic message, it sure blows apart the evolutionary theory of the society of man. They're lazy-minded, little cowards in their box who don't want your mind to be opened up. Don't listen to Scott. He'll make you ask me questions I can't answer. What do you think the pastors tell you? Don't listen to Scott for. You're going to ask him questions they can't answer. They can't play golf on Monday now. They got to go to the library. We can preach Jimmy Swaggart's message and go to, you know, cruise around motels with jogging pants with a crotch torn out. Driving along my automobile. I think we ought to hear that song. You want me to continue? This is a message that you ought to listen to. This is a message where everything is gained, nothing is lost for the Christian. What are they afraid of? Well, you can't be as stupid as most preachers want to remain. When your people start asking you questions about this, first of all, there's no comparison between the pyramid and the others, the Great Pyramid and the others, when it comes to size and precision of workmanship. The Great Pyramid is massive. If you visualize a 40-story building rising angularly from a 13.5-acre base, you get a good idea of the size of the structure. It has been estimated that the huge cathedrals of Milan and Florence, St. Paul's Basilica in Rome, and Westminster Abbey could be set within the confines of the Great Pyramid's base. I give you a little idea. Were we to grind the stone and its structure into gravel, we could lay a roadbed 18 feet wide and a foot thick all the way from New York to Salt Lake City. Each of the four triangular sides sloping upward from the base covers an area of nearly 5.5 acres. The exterior above the ground is 22 acres of surface, and at one time this exterior glistened in the sun like a brilliant jewel. Want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Each of the four triangular sides of the pyramid sloping upward from the base covers an area of nearly 5.5 acres. The exterior above the ground is 22 acres of surface, and at one time this exterior glistened in the sun like a brilliant jewel. Most of the time you see pictures of the pyramid, you see it without its exterior, with the rough appearance, as you see here on the cover of this book, or what you see on the dollar bill. But this Time Life series has a picture that is a little different. That sort of gets a, doesn't it? You can only come close, but it gives you a little idea of more like what the pyramid looked like with its limestone covers glistening in the sun before the Arabs tore it off to try to get the lime or to cover their mosques and houses in and around Cairo. This brilliant golden mount, as the Indian text referred to it, of the white limestone with the joints so tightly put together that you couldn't even see them. Indeed, the hinged door that opened it was so incapable of being seen that the Arabs who opened it dug in the center, missing it by some 24 or 25 feet because they couldn't see the hinged door, much less the other casings. It was a solid, shimmering, white marble pyramid as originally constructed, though I doubt the cornerstone on top was in place. At least that gives you a little different impression of the way it looked. The exterior above ground is 22 acres of surface, and at one time this exterior glistened in the sun like a brilliant jewel. White Tura limestone casing stones, finely polished, reflected light from the sun and the moon as did no other object ever built by man. The core masonry is made up of an estimated 2,300,000 blocks of limestone hewn from nearby quarries. The smallest of these blocks weighs nearly 3 tons. These huge pieces of limestone were cut, roughly dressed, and fitted together with a precision unmatched in any other pyramid. The casing stones quarried and transported across the Nile to the building site were 100 inches thick and weighed up to 20 tons. These huge casings were fitted with an optician's precision. You're hearing some of the same things because I'm just giving you the introduction from different authors. Some of these casings, still in place, are fitted so well that a business card cannot be inserted between the joints. The cement is so fine and amazingly strong that it boggles the minds of stonemasons today. The polished limestone blocks will fracture before the adhesion that joins them will give. Though poured vertical, less than a 50th of an inch, which separates the blocks. There is such a difference in the skill of the workmanship displayed between the Great Pyramid and the Second Pyramid that it is inconceivable that only one generation separated the two structures, a fact never mentioned in standard texts. You should be getting the idea by now The Great Pyramid is big and well built. It is such a fantastic piece of work that it has caught the fancy of every thoughtful visitor for the past 4,000 to 5,000 years. More words of praise have been written about this monument than there are blocks of stone in its makeup. Incidentally, you may see pictures of the Giza Pyramid complex where the second pyramid of Sephron appears to be taller than Cheops. This is because the second pyramid is built on higher ground and still has an apex or capstone, while the apex of the Great Pyramid is missing. The vastness of the job is one of the unsolved mysteries still perplexing today's scholars. Most of the other mysteries are avoided by the learned academicians, but they do allow that they have no idea how people living in the culture we assume existed in Egypt at the time could have built such an edifice. For example, that the Egyptians cut the rough blocks of the core masonry with the bronze tools of the day is not inconceivable, but they had to hew out the quarries more than 100 blocks a day, 7 days a week. I think it's inconceivable they could cut them 7 days a week in order to finish the job in 62 years, if Manetho's report to Herodotus is correct of the time span. Then, of course, the stones had to be transported to the building site and put into place. And most people don't sit down and figure out the mathematics of the stones and the accepted tradition of history that 100,000 workers were employed. You can add up how many hours, man hours, that made available. Then, of course, the stones had to be transported to the building site and put into place. How they managed to cut and dress the hard rose-colored granite blocks, which are said to weigh more than 85 tons each, transport them more than 200 miles to the site, put them in place, is even harder to determine. Cheops, or Khufu, according to the best guesses of modern scholars, Cheops being his Greek name, Khufu the Egyptian, such as Dr. I.E.S. Edwards, ruled for only 23 years. That's all that he ruled, all the records. This means his workers or slaves had to design, cut, transport, and fit all the core blocks at a speed of 300 a day, 7 days a week, in order to get everything ready during their boss's reign. The truth is, we don't know who, how, or when the Great Pyramid was built, despite the fact that scholars have had a pretty good data bank regarding all the other pyramids, which were undoubtedly tombs. Even the most dogmatic and pompous of Egyptologists is forced to admit he has no idea how the ancients managed to construct the Great Pyramid. A number of theories have been advanced, ranging from slaves tugging the blocks with ropes, and where they get all that rope, and rolling them on logs, and where they get all those trees, to the notion of mystics levitating the huge stones. If either of these two theories is correct, it is still not known how the masons applied the pressure required to dress the stones. It has been estimated that 2,000 pounds of pressure per square inch is needed to do the dressing work on the granite blocks. One student of the Great Pyramid has suggested that the greatest loss to modern times has been the apparent ability these ancient builders had to gather and organize such a workforce. Pyramids in general, and the Great Pyramid in particular, are far more ancient than the other images conjured up by thoughts of historic Egypt. The Great Pyramid existed thousands of years earlier than Akhenaten and Nefertiti, than Moses and the Exodus, than Antony and Cleopatra. In fact, it is because the Great Pyramid is so far removed from us in time that we have only elusive theories to work with. Estimates of when the structure was completed range as far back as the beginning of man. It is curious that among all the pieces of evidence archaeologists have uncovered that offer clues to the life and times of Cheops, nothing has been unearthed that conclusively links him with the construction of the Great Pyramid. There is a reference to Cheops having made some repairs, which seem to indicate that the building had been around for some time to need a little patch-up work. A lot of the speculation hinges on a painted cartouche found on the unpolished sides of the huge granite blocks that make up the ceiling of the main chamber of the Great Pyramid's interior. And I'll skip over that because another teaching, which I'll repeat again, we proved that that cartouche was a forgery. To give the one contribution Colonel Weiss wanted to justify the expense to his sponsor of his trip down there. If Khufu was related, more likely he took the name Khufu or Kuti, both of which mean glorious light or horizon of the heaven, to try to identify himself with the brilliance of the pyramid and its reflections, or to relate to a worship that already surrounded the pyramid in its mystery. In any event, the Great Pyramid has been dominating the landscape of Egypt for a long, long time, and it has outlasted everything else of importance in the ancient world. Where, for example, are the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the Colossus of Rhodes, the Lighthouse of Alexandria, and the fantastic city of Troy? To heighten the mystery, we find that not only is the Great Pyramid distinctly superior in size, shape, and excellence of workmanship, but also in orientation, location, and geometric precision. The orientation of the Great Pyramid to the cardinal points of the compass doesn't interest many people, but that's only because people seldom stop to ponder the difficulty of locating true north while living on a sphere that is spinning through the great void of space. We take the directions for granted these days, but 99.9% of us would fail dismally if we were required to locate true north using only the devices we ascribe to the ancient Egyptians. The near-perfect orientation of the Great Pyramid has caused great scholars to shake their heads in disbelief. How did the builders of this monument determine true north? After all, they're said to be only one step removed from the Stone Age, the period when ape-like creatures carried clubs, lived in caves, and hauled the women around by the hair. Frankly, the generally accepted view of prehistory is a gross distortion, and our ideas of the past need serious revision. Biblical revision, I might add. Recently, the Great Pyramid's remarkable orientation became a matter of scientific speculation once again. The March 1973 issue of Science magazine pictured the Giza complex on the cover, and featured an article by two foreign researchers who stated that the Great Pyramid is twisted slightly to the left or off true north by about 4 minutes of arc. It then was found that that shift was due to a shift in the continent rather than the pyramid being off true north. Today we have gyroscopes, and electronic gear, and orbiting satellites, and we know pretty well which way is up or north. But we're at least 5,000 years smarter than the pyramid builders.
This is the end of Side 3. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 4.
And we know pretty well which way is up or north. But we're at least 5,000 years smarter than the pyramid builders. The inconsistency of it all is appalling. If the general notion about the ancient Egyptians is correct, and they had a Bronze Age culture and capable of higher mathematics, since the Greeks invented it, they viewed their world as flat and somewhat smaller than the planet Earth. They supposedly didn't know such a thing as a pole existed, so they couldn't have cared about true north. If that's true, then the orientation of the poles is pure coincidence, and so are the location and the geometric precision built into it. Not only did they accidentally orient the Great Pyramid to the cardinal points, they accidentally selected the prime meridian and the Tropic of Capricorn as their location. Pick a globe map of the Earth, use a piece of string to make the meridian. Line from North Pole to South Pole through the spot where the Great Pyramid is located. You will notice that you cross the greatest mass of land on the planet's north-south axis. If you're going to attempt to disprove this, please be certain to subtract the difference from large bodies of water whenever alternative meridians are considered. The pyramid meridian misses the extended tip of Africa, but not northern Europe. Such a meridian would be perfect for use as the Earth's prime meridian, and it makes more sense than using the line that passes through Greenwich, England. The line going around the globe from west to east, or the pyramid's precise latitude, also appears to pass through more land mass than any other line. There are many people who believe the Great Pyramid is therefore situated at the center of the Earth's land mass and exactly quarters that mass. It's either a happy coincidence or planned that way. And if it was planned, somebody knew a lot more about the size and shape of our planet than we give the Egyptians credit for knowing at that time. As we go along, it'll become more and more apparent to you that whoever built the Great Pyramid knew as much or more about this planet than we know today. An answer to anyone who claims the orientation was coincidence because the early Egyptians could not possibly have known our planet is a sphere that orbits the sun. I'd like to take this opportunity to point out that one of Pharaoh's many glorious titles was Lord of the Orbit. Now I ask you, orbit of what? Finally, we find that the Great Pyramid is also distinctly superior in regard to geometric precision. Long before Pythagoras, some pyramid designer knew about the 3-4-5 triangle and the 2 square root of the 5-3 triangle. Long before Archimedes traveled to Egypt and then returned to Syracuse and exclaimed, "Eureka," meaning "I found it," some pyramid designer was aware of the universal geometric relationship between the diameter of a circle and its circumference, pi, 3.14159, without which you could never deal with the reality of the universe. Even the mathematical concept of pi or the golden mean was evidently known by the designer of the Great Pyramid. As we shall see later, certain rugged individuals refused to ignore many pieces of the Great Pyramid's evidential puzzle. Therefore, many outlandish theories based on the structure's geometric precision have developed. So many unusual and utterly fantastic things are implied with the linear measurements and slopes of angle that the Great Pyramid has been surveyed more closely than any other edifice ever erected. Before any more is said, we must realize that all the measurements have been taken in modern times, many thousands of years after construction, earthquakes, subsidence, wind and sand erosion, human vandalism, and perhaps even continental drift, which explains it being that minor variation off true north, have winded by since the days of the pyramid's construction. Despite this, the perfections in the structure of the Great Pyramid are mind-boggling. Such perfections incorporated into a pyramid shape could not have been discovered by studying the second or third or any other pyramids. They simply don't have it. The other two large pyramids at Giza are grand attempts at copying a forgotten ability or never known ability that had been known by a culture antedating these Egyptians. The Egyptians who did this were remarkable enough in their own right, but their work attests to their having too little too late. The prime question regarding the Great Pyramid, no matter what theory one favors, is why was it built at all? Why would any people go to the Herculean effort to build a monument the likes of the Great Pyramid? The implications are awesome. To avoid confronting more serious and far-reaching possibilities, scholars cling tenaciously to the idea that it was nothing more than a tomb for a ruling maniac. A tomb certainly didn't require the various aspects of material and geometric perfection embodied in this grandest of monuments, particularly when, apparently, the ordinary laborers who helped in its construction had to have the real measurements of the pyramid translated through the map room of the antechamber into their royal cubit, rather than the sacred cubit, which is the key to all of its measurements. So you build all this into it to make an impression on the people who don't even understand it, that are helping you build it? The implications are awesome. This inference is made all the more obvious when we see that all the other pyramids, which were tombs, didn't have material and geometric precision. From the evidence unearthed, scholars cannot determine who, how, or when the Great Pyramid was built. They all come to the same conclusion. However, does it really matter? Must we know the name of the obvious superintelligent builders? Must we understand their methods of construction? Must we know the exact dates of the construction to understand that this monument has a great deal of significance? If the why of the Great Pyramid can be shown with reason, and we can make use of what is implied, then the rest is just packaging. But before we tackle the why in detail, let's first explore an outline of history that disagrees with the accepted view of what went on many thousands of years ago, but does indeed agree with much archaeological evidence that has been heretofore ignored and left outside the framework of historical understanding. I am convinced the builders of the Great Pyramid were a remnant of a fantastic civilization that existed during the ages we now call prehistoric. Who? And that is the question that waits a little more introduction.